You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I'll be speaking with Chuck Rosenthal. Chuck is a writer, primarily fiction. He has published at least 15 books. His latest, which is Awake Forever in a Sweet Unrest, we'll be speaking about today. But Chuck has done a lot of different things. He was a cowboy. He was a cowboy. He was a surfer and professor of English literature. He studied English, studied sociology, sociological theory, philosophy, and earned his PhD. I believe it was the University of Utah. And he most recently taught at Loyola Marymount in Los Angeles. He has done a lot of different things, promises to be an interesting conversation. And as I say, we'll be speaking mostly about his, I think, mostly about his new book, Awake Forever in a Sweet Unrest, which talks about the romantic poets in a very interesting and creative way. It takes place in the basement of Beyond Baroque, a long-standing literary establishment in Los Angeles, a real place. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it, and I hope you will listen in. Well, hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and that other person on the screen, the one with more hair on his face, and perhaps we're similar on our heads,
it's debatable.
Yeah, it depends on the angle.
Yeah,
it's Chuck.
I like short people.
right. Chuck Rosenthal. So Chuck Rosenthal. Now, Chuck, I didn't say this to you. I already did a separate introduction that speaks okay. about who you are somewhat, but at the risk of like perhaps if I left something that you feel is important to put in. Could you give a short potted bio? How did you come to be what you are, and what are you? Well, and then we can talk about.
Well, that's a long story.
Yeah, it's true.
I do have a memoir which I published in 2005, but that only has to do with one aspect of who I am and what I had to overcome in my life. But I'm from Erie, Pennsylvania, which is currently buried under snow. That's one reason I'm not there.
You're not there.
although I still have a couple nieces there. My parents got me my big sister's tricycle. She's still alive and teaching in Pittsburgh. I don't know why it happened, but they put a horse head and a saddle on it. And I used to ride around the neighborhood. I remember at age three on that. Back then, you could ride around the neighborhood on a tricycle.
Yeah. And nobody would be watching. You could just ride around the neighborhood.
There were neighbors everywhere, and everybody knew everyone. But my mother was a devout Polish Catholic. My father was German and not Catholic. And I'm a Rosenthal. So there's some Jewish heritage there, but I wasn't raised as a Jew. My father had to sign his life away to marry a Catholic, and whom he loved. So they made six children. I played basketball. I guess mostly would be what as a teenager and well into college. And I was pretty good, and that was a big part of my life, and it taught me a lot of discipline, but it also along with the Catholic Church, gave me a profound dislike of organization. So one day I quit it all. I stopped doing all that, and the war was on, and it was difficult times. So that was pretty formative. That was a pretty formative period. I went on to I majored in English and philosophy. I went on to philosophy graduate school for a master's, and then went on for a PhD, and I found that my interests, which at the time in the mid 70s was animal intelligence, did not coincide with what the department decided was what should be the interests of a philosopher. And I was at SUNY Buffalo at the time, and I ran away from that. So I have a good po long policy of running away, but always running into things. And at that point, I decided to start reasonlessly start writing, and I kept a journal and wrote some pretty mediocre kind of beatnik poetry. But I finally decided to write a novel, and I did. And I wrote a novel about my time in college and quitting basketball. And it was strange times,
And
like
you and you
69,
haven't
70,
stopped.
71, strange times, right? But I wrote three novels there in Erie, Pennsylvania. One, two, and decided I looked at a map and pointed to places I wanted to go, Boston and New York and California. And I went to Davis because I thought I could just walk to the beach, which you can't walk to the beach from Davis.
It's a long walk.
You could bicycle.
It's a long bike ride,
I don't
too.
know, but nine, only but 90 miles. I don't know, but and that was good. I learned a lot in graduate school, and I actually decided to go on for a PhD at Davis, and they didn't really want me to do a dissertation on Kerouac. And at the time, I was very into Kerouac, and I have read all of Kerouac and taught classes in Kerouac, and enjoyed him and loved him, and influenced by him. But I don't write like him, and I'm not so enamored now. That's a long time ago, right? Kerouac and the Beats. So I left Davis
You
too,
did that. You did that again. You left Pennsylvania. You left Buffalo. You left Davis. I think that was all were all good things to leave. If you just measured it by the cities.
So I took my motorcycle across Canada and across the United States, looking at places I might want to go, and I chose Salt Lake City because it was the closest place to California that I had a creative dissertation. So I went there,
You
and
couldn't walk to the beach, but you could walk to the lake.
well, you could get to the Salt Lake, but that's not good swimming or good weather. But and then some things changed. I got interested in the magic realism as writing, and that really influenced my writing. And I ran into a poet there named Gail Ronsky, who is a surrealist, and she turned my head about language in a lot of ways. And one day, when I was writing a novel about the Emperor Hadrian, good God, would that have been a mistake? But it'd be another unpublished book. I sat down and started Loop's Progress, and became my first published novel, and found my voice, and I knew it. I knew it. I felt it. And from then, right? Yeah. From then, I wrote and found a job out here, and
You wrote, you taught.
so. Yeah, my true love wanted to be a cowgirl poet, and of course the cowgirls did not want her kind of surrealist poetry. But he wanted me to go country dancing, and I said, "I'm not going country dancing unless I can ride a horse." So I started renting horses, and then I wrote a book about a young girl who learns to be a barrel rider in Wyoming, like her grandmother, and it was very, very successful. So it's Elena of the Stars, is that book. And I bought a horse. And in many ways, people regarded it as a huge mistake because they really didn't know how to ride. And this horse was a magnificent Anglo-Arab mare, as hot as could be. But I learned a lot. It really changed my life. And I spent 10 years almost every day with that animal. And it worked. She broke. She fell in love with me.
She broke you.
Yeah. But I learned so much. I really became quite a good rider and trainer. And that's why I guess my publicist likes to talk to me about cowboy turned intellectual, but actually it's all upside down. But 25 years of riding, and unfortunately my body gave out, about age 70, my hips and my back couldn't sustain even so. And it was basketball that did that to me, not horseback riding. But and okay. I just kept writing.
And this most recent book published this past year, yes? You can hold up the title.
Yes, Awake Forever in Sweet Unrest.
Awake Forever in Sweet Unrest.
And the story for that is in 2011, I was teaching at the Imperial College in London. I was teaching, fun stuff, Virginia Woolf and Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland and fun stuff. And, yeah. But I had just, when I got there, I had just finished radiation for cancer. And I was waking up in the middle of the night, afraid of death. And I would pour a glass of port and stare out this huge window at the front of the house and watch the buses, double-decker buses, go by and read William Blake, who I'd never read before, despite, having a PhD. Huh. I was really astounded by Blake as an intellect and an imagination. And that's when my life partner went up to, when we got back to her office. And I was writing another book then, right? I must have written a couple novels between now and then. But I began reading the Romantics. She came down with a stack of books, all of the Romantic poetry, all Wordsworth, Coleridge, John Keats, Percy Bysshe Shelley, Lord Byron. And of course, I had read Frankenstein, taught Frankenstein. I loved that novel. And I started reading them and becoming more and more fascinated by them. And so I read biographies.
Did you ever read the biographies? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. After I read the biographies and Mary Shelley's comments on Shelley's comments on his poetry, which is really fascinating. She's a really fascinating woman. And that's where if you're in the library, in the haunted library in this book, where Beatrice starts her journeys, Mary Shelley is a pretty ambivalent figure. She's not very giving. She wants to turn Beatrice on and then doesn't, and is afraid of trying to convince her of too much. And so that's a fascinating relationship. And some people have called it a philosophical one, which I guess, how did I know? they talk because there's issues here, right?
Is there ever a time in the book where you make it clear to a reader who is not versed with the Romantic poets that character X is in fact Mary Shelley?
Yeah, no, she confesses to that, and Beatrice's mother gives her a copy of Frankenstein. Gives Beatrice a copy.
Eve gives Beatrice a copy. Right.
They're interested in Mary Shelley, and she questions Mary Shelley about it a lot. But Mary Shelley goes very anti-intellectual on her and says, "I just wanted to write a horror story." And the story behind that, right? She was with a guy named William Polidori and Byron and Shelley, and they're in that castle above the lake in Italy, and they're reading German horror stories translated into French, and they're having so much fun. Shelley and Byron say, why don't we all write a novel, each of us, and then we'll come back and show the novels. And then the weather got better, and Shelley and Byron went off horseback riding and sailing. And Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein, 19 years old.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable, right?
Really remarkable.
And the other person there, William Polidori, writes the first Dracula novel, which people don't really know. That's called Dracula. But it's very short and not considered to be very good at all, but even by Mary Shelley. But, and of course, he was left alone with her, and he had a crush on her, and there's, you know, that's always going on with these people.
Yes.
But you know that, I mean, Shelley crosses France, right? And walks across France with Mary Shelley and her younger stepsister, a year younger. And Beatrice joins that, right? And walks across France. But Shelley, of course, is sleeping with both the sisters. Byron's notorious. Keats is a little more of a pure heart. But these are all very romantic situations for Beatrice when she goes back and encounters these people. They're very sexy, intelligent, passionate. They're the rock stars of their era, particularly Byron, right? He can write anything and send it back to England, and it'll be in print, and people will go crazy for it. So I don't know.
I have a question for you. Do you feel like it's what?
Okay, you asked about whether I ever speak explicitly to the reader about who these people are.
I was curious.
And I do. I'm very this narrator. In some ways, it is a little bit like falling when I fell into a loop. Is I really fell into this narrator. He's just confident and authoritative and feels like he can do anything. And he does. If you consider him a part of this book and he is telling the story, he does it, right? Fantastic things happen in this book. And I just do them. I just can do it. You can do this. Because you know what? You can always throw it away or erase it. You don't have to.
Right. Yes.
You know, just do it. But it really synced up. In this novel. This novel really is exciting from one chapter to the next. You really want to know what's going to happen.
Why did you decide, I don't know if this is a question that even can be answered, but why did you decide that this was an important book to write? Because there's something about the romantic poets that you think is, why should people care right now?
You know that's a good question, because I thought more people knew more about them than they do or did. So I didn't take it into my objectives to say,
I'm going to write about that.
An important book, and I guess it does turn people on to this crowd of people, I wish people knew more about them. And
do you have a clue about why it turns people on? Why this book seems to be, I think it seems to be something that people are moved by, noticed by. Obviously, yes, it's the writing for sure. And is there something about the times we are in? And the romantic poets, or the romantics, and what they were in, the times they were in, and some of the questions that they were wrestling with,
like Napoleon, right? For one, and the colonization, and they considered that, you know, the denuding of the American landscape. They were opposed to that, and Byron was opposed to the taking of the Greek ancient Greek statues from the Parthenon and taking them to England, and so they were politically active, and that's an interesting thing about that time and this time. And it was a very insecure time for so many people then, and we indeed live in a very insecure time now. And I don't want to say that I wrote the book to, for people to find security in an insecure time, but I did want the book to be a refuge from all of the things that are.
It's interesting. I felt like I admit to not reading all of it. And you know, well, no, I take that back. I admit to not reading all of it as thoroughly and as many times as I wanted to feel like I'm comfortable speaking about it. But I feel like that some of the wrestling that the characters went on, right? That some of the things that the characters were wrestling with in the book are so similar to some of the things that either people are wrestling with or ought to be wrestling with right now, in our time.
Sexuality for one, of course, Mary Shelley's father, William Godwin, was a notorious liberal intellectual, and so he was for liberating the Irish, for universal education, right. Liberation of women. He was against marriage, as was Percy Bysshe Shelley, and so that institution and the way that it dominated, you know, women were powerless. And
yeah, exactly.
The only power they could seem to be able to achieve was through marriage. So Shelley married twice, of course. His first wife who died, who drowned herself in the Serpentine, right? In those between Kensington and I think Hyde Park. I walked around those places and just studied them. Mm. But I did that for the Peter Pan book, not for this book. So everything seemed at stake, and these guys were really, really, really taking things on. Everything was at stake for them, and they were so passionate, and they believed in themselves so much. But and also very powerful personalities and very powerful egos. They really cared about being famous poets and wanting to be famous poets, and they were. So in some ways, yeah, I was surprised by how important this book became, and these characters came alive, and you know, they made it come alive, and also the issue in that goes way back. The essence of truth for these writers was the imagination and the heart. The imagination and the heart, not
fact. Not,
not,
fact.
Not logic, not right.
Right.
Look where we are now. We're exploring the edge of the universe and we still don't have a clue what's
right.
going on.
Right. Well, and we don't have a clue of how we're going to get ourselves out of some of the things that we've taken ourselves into with our pursuit, you know. And I'm, look what we're doing right now. Here we are, we're in two separate places and we have the ability to speak to each other like this. What a miraculous thing. And we all know the havoc that social media, some of our the technological obsession is wreaking on our state of mind, etc. So we're wrestling with some of those very things right now. And you know, you said it a moment ago, we're devastating so much of the natural environment, and where do we look for the solutions to that, rather than so often it's rather than looking to nature and natural processes, it's looking to the next technological innovation that will bail our asses out of this mess that we've created.
So that would be, you know, the answer by for Coleridge and for Shelley and Byron and Keats is It's inside, it's the heart, and metaphor is as close as we can get. And Keats says, I'm writing to lift the veil of reality, to reveal the truth and beauty underneath.
Right.
Well, okay,
right.
That's right, that's right. But and that's all, you know, that's all Emersonian, that's our, you know, that's almost a religious statement, right? But
did you find yourself
thing? It's a very powerful thing, and I'm not against it. I'm not against cell phones. I'm not against them. I didn't want to crusade, right? I'm not a crusader. I didn't want, but personally, see myself, I stopped watching television in 2013. I don't know that world, except by conversations.
Do you watch movies?
Not much.
Not much.
Not,
interesting.
Not very much. Somebody better be talking about it for 2 years. And then I said, right. Okay, you're still talking about it? Okay, I'll take a look at that.
I'll see what that is, right.
So I did watch the Beatles documentary, but that's, you know, because that's my area, right?
Did you feel like you put your hand, like your thumb on the scale as you were writing it? Like you wanted it to come out a certain sort of way? Or did it sort of, did it surprise you and it reveal itself in ways that were surprising? Or did you, or do you feel like, you were rooting for one character or another, right? That, you know what I mean?
No, I let myself be surprised. This is my shortest book, and it took me the longest time to research and write it. So it took me a long time. I did a lot of thinking, and I lived with these. But I had these characters at my feet, their biographies and their poems, and they were there all the time. And I lived with them, and I knew them, and I really, really knew them. I had absolute confidence that I could sit among them and talk with them, and know what they were saying. And
did you ever talk with them?
So they surprised me all the time, because sometimes I would just sit and look and say, okay, what's this person going to say next? And or what are we going to do next? And then if they ask, well, I don't know, what would Melville do?
I don't know if this is a fair question, but so you knew them well, and you could speak with them, and they would surprise you. Did you think? I know this is the nutty part, right? Do you think you surprised them? Like, did you have something to say to them?
I don't think characters are. I don't think I surprised them. I think I could, maybe, if I spent some time with them, we could have some fun. But I don't know. I don't use laudanum. You know, they use vodka. They use vodka and opium.
No television or laudanum.
I don't know. I don't think I surprised them, because I saw them as things that I created on the page, and things who were on or in their work, but I didn't see them as people. I didn't regard them as people.
And what about Beatrice?
Beatrice, well, she was an amazing discovery. I don't know. My child, who was a performance artist in Sydney, she's been there for, I don't know, 14, 15 years now. But she dropped out of high school. And that was one. I wanted somebody in that way, but the character Beatrice is not based on Marlena Dolly, my child, but she really had to be curious and brave and frightened, and that decision to go into the library and then back to the library and back to the library, and her development really, really fascinated me. Because she was coming out of these circumstances, learning more and more, and watching herself, and it also cradling her naivete and ignorance. Sometimes she said, "No, you know, I'm not ready. Are you ready to read this?" Say, "No, I'm not ready to read this. I'm still getting to know these guys," and sees that as an education. So She's the answer to this book. No Beatrice, no book. She's got to be the person that the foil for these people in and ever again and again and again and again, and they're bouncing their brilliance off of her, and she's taking it. And she's taking it in and absorbing it. And then the next time she's there, right, she's coming back with things to say to them. And so in that way, she was really, really fun. And it made it, you know, how was it going to end this?
It's interesting that from the outside looking in, I know it doesn't necessarily look like this from an author's perspective, but from a reader's perspective, and just the way saw the structure of the book, like you were in conversation with the romantics, and the only other person in the book who was in conversation with the romantics was Beatrice. So that's why my question is, did you ever surprise them? And I'm not sure. I think you might be selling yourself short.
I think she surprises them. Surprises them, and especially the second time around. You know, she goes to sees each of them two times.
Twice.
And actually, I was going to end it with six times, but I realized that the burial scene, the cremation scene on the beach, had to be a final thing. I had to be in one of the endings, and there are several endings in this this book.
Do you think somebody can appreciate the, well, they can obviously appreciate, do you think they can appreciate the book if they don't understand or they don't know much about the romantic poets or that period? So they obviously can appreciate it, but did you write it for people who knew about the romantics, or did you just write it because it was a great story that revealed itself to you?
Yeah, number two, I didn't write it for romantic scholars. I am not a scholar. I am not a biographer. I am not a poet. I'm not a historian. I'm a novelist, and I've been doing it a long time, and I really know how to give one, let the story go where it's going to go, and two, let the characters take it there.
Mm-hmm.
Let those characters take it there, and boy, they do. They're really, powerful people that have interesting things to say and interesting things to do and great passions. So,
you know, to the non-writers in the world, right? To the non-novelists, that's always such a the characters took it places, but the characters were just sitting at your feet in a bunch of pages, right?
No,
did they take it there, or did Chuck take it there? It's a good question. It's all, for the non-writer. Yeah, I follow them. Yeah,
I follow them, or my narrator does. You see, I definitely am willing to distinguish between an author and a narrator. So I'm not the narrator. I'm the person who's writing that narrator. That gets complicated. Yeah. And let's not. I won't. Don't want to. Do that.
There's no way out of that one anyway.
But I. Right. Yeah. I had all these lives in front of me, their whole lives of each of them in front of me. So I got to choose, when she goes back, which part of the part of their lives is she entering? And there's specific parts. And that, I don't know, intellectually, I can't tell you why I chose those moments, but I knew that they were the right moments, and they built over, over time. So I do not think I do not think you need to know anything about the romantic poets to read this book, because these people are really fascinating.
Yes,
If you open the pages of this book and enter this book, you're going to be fascinated. Even Christina Acevedo is no slouch. She's a pretty good character, and she's in a tough position because she's the boss, and nothing's happening down there in that library as far as she's concerned. But it was handed to me. They're all wonderful characters. Even Sam on the beach, right? Who may or may not be Coleridge. Look what he does. Amazing. It's amazing what he becomes.
And, he may or may not be.
So they're all really. So that was there for me. I didn't have to invent any of them. I just had to discover them. I guess Beatrice is an invention, and hooray.
Yeah, indeed.
Falling on her because I needed someone to be. When I started off, she was in her late 20s and knew who the romantics were. And I said, no, that can't be written. That book can't be written. I'll end up in like dialogues and discussions about what she already knows. No, she's got to be much tabula rasa. She's got to be walking into this for the first time.
Mm.
And discovering this and being young enough, 19, to do that. So that worked out. When I turned that corner, that was a big deal. In the end, she drives the book. It's her book.
It's absolutely her book.
Yeah. She becomes an adult in these 89 pages.
It's almost like you want more. What's her life like afterwards? And it's almost like, from the outside in, it's like, hey, I wonder what happened next. Hello. Well, we're back after technological difficulties. And
we're back. We think we're back. Yes.
Yes, we think we're back. It's good to know, right? So I had just asked if, I had just said that, geez, I was interested. I wanted to know, geez, and how does Beatrice turn out? Because she is so young in the book. And then I segued to, and speaking of what's next, is there a next for Chuck? And I don't mean with respect to the romantics and Beatrice or any Beatrice and anybody else, but are you pondering another?
Yes. And I did start again. I started two other novels and got about 50 pages into one and 10 into the other. And I walked away and I've been thinking and thinking and thinking. And I had a lot of fun in interplanetary travel in the heart of my novel, The Heart of Mars. And I really loved being on Europa and Mars 500 years in the future. Anyways, so yes, I'm thinking of doing a novel set on Planet Nine. That planet out there, beyond the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna. Yep. That leaves it wide open. I can do whatever I want. And so that's what I'm gonna try next. I've just got to make that world possible, at least on the page, right?
Yeah. Have you ever written like a science fiction book before? Is that what you're imagining? Is this a science? Will this be a quote science fiction book or no?
No. The Heart of Mars, when it got reviewed and got good reviews, sci-fi people said it's not science fiction.
It's not science fiction, right?
So there was that. I think I'm a fabulist or kind of a fantasy writer, a magical writer. So yeah. I think I'm going to go with that over the science. Imagination.
Yeah, right, exactly. The science fiction crowd is a very particular, they're a very fussy crowd.
Well, most genre crowds are fussy. Detective, right? Horror, suspense. They know what they want and they want it and it has to come when they want it, how they want it. Okay, that's okay. No, this will not be sci-fi per se. I think it'll be more fantasy.
Yeah.
And
is it in the works up here or is it in the works
barely
down here?
No, it's not there yet. No, it's not there yet. And I don't know what is going to bring it about or how it's got to bring it about. I think I've got a number, you know, there are a number of epic things that writing, you know, there's the Iliad, the Odyssey, and the, you know, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata. There's some wonderful epics out there, and I'm thinking of just poaching some episodes and putting them on Planet Nine. And I think there's got to be somebody's got to try to get home, and that's a good plot line.
Yes.
So it's going to have to be a pretty fantastic place because it's really a, I don't know.
Would you be willing to speak just generally a little bit about writing itself at the moment? Just because, I mean, you are, well, from your point of view, I don't know if you're prolific, but what, it's been what, 19 books, 18 books, something like that?
Yeah, this is my 20th book.
This would be the 20th.
15th novel.
That's a lot.
Yeah, so, well, you are what you eat. Well, you are what you read.
Do you love it?
And yes.
Do you still love it?
Yes. Yeah, I love writing this book, and I love when I finished it, I really fell in love with it more because it was hard work. But so, you know, it's like anything that's hard work, you know, whether it was basketball or my horse, right?
Yes.
I was afraid to go see her every day for 10 years. So that's okay. But I loved it. And it's the same thing with any passion, right? It takes a lot of work, and even a love relationship. It takes, mm-hmm. you know, there's, it doesn't just lean on in that one direction.
Do you write every day?
Do I write every
do
day?
Do you write every day?
Not now. This is the first time I haven't been writing every day in memory. I don't remember, but I'm really trying to, as a number of people around me have said, because this is a really hot book. It's got legs. People want to read it. It's a good book. So take my time and give it the time to promote it. So I've done a dozen or more interviews, and I've got several really superb reviews. The California Review of Books and the Reader's Favorite gave me just sensational reviews. And of course, I want a prize. I want a book. Best book of the year from Shelf Independent, independent organization of independent publishers.
That's something to underline. That's significant.
No, right. So I got a little badge on my cover now. See, on this cover, here's my book. There's no little badge on it that says,
where is it?
Winner of.
Oh, there isn't. Right.
Yeah. No,
it will be.
If you go on Amazon now, you'll see the book with the prize on the cover.
Really?
Yeah.
Good. That's great.
It's on there. But it's hard for me. I really want to be writing. And I really.
Wait, what does that mean? So why can't you? I mean, when you say you're promoting it, you're promoting it.
I keep a journal, but I bored myself. I said, this is not interesting. I'm not creating here. And I guess I'm beyond there. You know, I used to just say, well, you could just write like that and be practice. And it is. And when I sit down to write, even when I was sitting down to write Awake Forever in a sweet unrest, when I would worry, wait a minute, this isn't any good, you'd say, no, this is just practice. This is just practice. You don't get better without practicing. Uh-huh. And some things, right, over and over and over. When I played basketball, I would work on a move. And until I made it 10 times in a row, I wouldn't move on to the next move. So I spent many hours perfecting. Yeah. So that was love. But that was painful, too. You know what? So it's hard to say. You know what drives us? What drives us? But writing is what I discovered could drive me. And you know, I can't dunk anymore.
Exactly.
There's
a limit.
Yeah, there's so. But I can still write. I can still write.
Write. You literally write with pencil and paper.
This book I did. This book I really wanted to take my time. I think the previous book, which was Let's Face the Music and Dance, which was a very, very challenging book. But I wrote sometimes on paper and sometimes on on the computer. So I've been evolving more towards using the laptop. But circumstances changed. You know, I have a little cabin down below my property, and I write there, and I have my tabletop computer there. But so circumstances have changed, and we'll see. I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to go to Planet Nine.
That's, you're going to go to Planet Nine.
And, I'll put my pencil on my shoulder and carry it to Planet Nine.
And what is, so you stopped teaching, as I understand it, right? You stopped teaching.
I stopped in,
recently.
Two years ago now.
2 years ago. And so what does promoting the book look like? Doing something like this, but also... Yes. But what else? Do you go do readings? Do you get?
I do some readings, and I have one. I've had a couple, and I'm doing one in San Diego in January the 25th. So, my Coriolis, who has represented me here, gives me pictures and quotes from my book, and I put them on Facebook or Instagram, and but I found that world a little too challenging and not really a world I truly enjoy,
right.
That kind of communication, that immediate, but I do that. And if I get in touch with people, and of course when I won this prize, I got on this internet and emailed a lot of people.
Yeah.
And told them, you know, that, I won the prize. So I don't know. I'm not an entrepreneur, and I have not in the past. Really, this is the first book I've really tried.
That you're trying to promote.
I had some books that were from bigger presses, where the press themselves made some attempts to promote, but really not nearly as aggressively as, say, Coriolis.
Promotes. That's great.
Promoted to like interviews and reviews.
That's great.
I try to be there. I try to be available. And so this kind of dominates my life. So, an event like this is easy and it's comfortable and it's,
and yeah, it's fun. And the commute is easy.
Still takes up psychological, space as teaching did, of course, walking in a classroom, you know,
right.
That, not every day, because teachers get nice summer breaks and things, but
yeah, that's true.
Every time. And I'd be queasy before I walked in the classroom every time.
I know that feeling. I know that feeling.
It's a performance. Right?
I did it for 40 years, and you know, I always had stage fright in every class.
Well,
I mean, some days worse than others, but you know.
Yeah, that's why.
Yeah.
I just tell them stories.
Yeah, and see, I love it.
That's a story.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, indeed. Well, Chuck Rosenthal, congratulations on the prize. And congratulations on the book. And
I should be awake forever in a sweet unrest.
Yes, indeed. Hold it up again. Awake forever in a sweet unrest. Move it into the, there we go. Right, awake forever in a sweet unrest. And did we already talk about it? Did you say where that came from?
Yeah, no, but if you read Keats' collected works,
right,
the last poem, which
is it Bright?
Bright Star. Right. It's the third line.
Yes.
From the end. Third line from the end.
Yes.
And,
exactly.
When I ran into that, I wrote down Awake Forever and used that as my working title. And eventually I took the rest of it.
Yeah.
And it's there. And it's a beautiful line, anyways. And it expresses Keats's negative capability, that which I don't dwell on that, because that's a tough thing to talk about. But I really, you know, I really understood that. But by the time I wrote this book, I knew that theory of creation, that emptying out in order to find what's underneath, which could be the unconscious, the subconscious, the imagination, depending, you know, who you ask. Coleridge or Freud.
Well, I'm looking forward to seeing what's going on Planet Nine. So get on it.
Yeah.
And thank you for spending the time.
Thank you for having me, David.
And sorry for the technological difficulty. I'm glad it was at your end and not at mine. But well, I'll make sure to put them together.
It's on some end, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, computer people and horse people will always tell you it's your fault. It's not the computer's fault. It's not the horse's fault. It's your fault.
Okay, good. All righty. Take care.
Take care, David. Thank you.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.